You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 10th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nick Estes, host of the Red Nation podcast and co-author of The Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. Also on the program today, 19 Republicans vote yes for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which has just momentarily passed, or I should say moments ago passed in the Senate. Meanwhile, Democrats unveil the $3.5 trillion budget blueprint. This is for the infrastructure reconciliation bill, the Voterama, where amendments will be offered by anybody and everybody to start today. Meanwhile, it's unclear how the White House will deal with the debt limit vote as Yellen calls for Congress to raise it. The Delta variant now sending more children to the hospital as schools in Republican states are suing those states to be allowed to require masks for students when they show up at schools. Arkansas on the verge of running out of ICU beds as Texas Governor Abbott desperately seeks for outside help. U.S. military has gotten the word, and they will mandate vaccines. And as we speak, lonely Andrew Cuomo is speaking and scrambling to buy time as impeachment looms in the New York State Assembly. Meanwhile, the Biden administration accused in court filings of violating the Flores Agreement over deplorable conditions in detaining immigrant children. Lastly, climate change could be on the verge of permanently disrupting a delicate Atlantic ocean balance, last experienced in the lead-up of the last ice age. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies. We've gotten just a flood of news is happening as we go live. One being the passage of the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, the Portman Cinema bill. This has about $550 billion of new spending. And then another $450 billion, which has been sort of reappropriated from some of the COVID relief bills, other places. Nevertheless, $550 billion of new infrastructure spending, necessary but insufficient down payment on some of the physical infrastructure in this country, including things like public transportation and broadband internet, a way of transitioning to electric cars. And this as we have the new IPCC report that came out from the United Nations, which says that we're just in real rough shape in terms of climate change. And with that, hello, Emma Vigeland. How are
hello.
You?
Hello. I'm fine, despite the existential dread of climate change.
You know, it is...
And COVID and... our country falling apart.
It is amazing to me that there are seven states, I think it was, six or seven states, I headline this, I think Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, maybe Arkansas, a couple others, where schools, sometimes school systems, sometimes individual public schools, are suing their states to simply be allowed to require students to wear masks. And then you think about the idea.
I know.
You think about the idea that we are trying to deal with climate change, and we can't even deal with the pandemic that's right in front of our faces. As Arkansas runs out of ICU beds, as Texas, the state where the lieutenant governor bragged about sacrificing their older folks for the sake of the younger folks who are now going into the hospital at a higher rate than they were with the wild type of COVID, it is really disturbing. We have new breaking news that it warrants this. Do you have my board up, Matt? Okay. We only bring out this music when it's really important.
The royalties are crazy on it.
It is now being reported, I guess, by Governor Andrew Cuomo himself during this speech that has been going on since we started the show, that Andrew Cuomo is resigning from office and his resignation will be effective within 14 days. That is it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, the writing was on the wall about that impeachment, old buddy, old pal.
Yep, I think Andrew Cuomo did not want to be impeached. Let's play that clip. Do we have that clip?
Yeah, this is from his press conference where, you know, he like won't admit to sexually assaulting / harassing people. But is this the one where he says he didn't realize how the line had been drawn, or?
Oh, this is him resigning. Now, we should say that what preceded this was him saying he has once again re-evaluated his behavior. This is like the fourth or fifth re-evaluation of his behavior that he's had. And he has once again re-evaluated his behavior with, I would imagine, all 11 women. And, I mean, let's be honest. If you need to re-evaluate your behavior with 11 women, including one state trooper who, you know, is on your security detail, the chances are there might be more than those 11 that you've probably been.
And after denying, then casting aspersions on the investigation that you asked for, the independent investigation. I mean, like, let's be real. The only reason his re-evaluation has come to a different conclusion is because of pending political humiliation.
Right. I mean, his aides have all...
Worse than this.
His aides have quit. The we have leaders of other groups who were advising him. The leader of one of the Me Too groups had to quit because she had advised him on how to navigate this.
Yeah.
Here is Andrew Cuomo saying bye-bye.
This is one of the most challenging times for government in a generation. Government really needs to function today. Government needs to perform. It is a matter of life and death, government operations. And wasting energy on distractions is the last thing that state government should be doing. And I cannot be the cause of that. New York tough means New York loving. And I love New York. And I love you. And everything I have ever done has been motivated by that love. And I would never want to be unhelpful in any way. And I think that given the circumstances, the best way I can help now is if I step aside.
I really hope you don't love New Yorkers in the way that you like to express love, or at least I guess I should say it's an expression
domination.
Of power.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's right. Does he know the difference between power and expressions of affection and love? Seems to be the only thing he loves is power.
Well, the bottom line is, I think he has chosen the best sort of rhetorical route out, if you will, which is to make himself the martyr for the sake of good governing. He would, of course, be exonerated, but he does not want to put New York through this trauma because of those multitude of people who have insisted that he did something that, of course, he did not do. And because he's not only New York tough, but he's New York love, he will step aside because he's the bigger and better man than all of the women who accused him and, of course, all of the men who wanted to hold him to account. In fact, he is the best of all of us.
Oh.
And therefore, he has decided to step down, even though you probably none of you deserve that break that he's giving everyone, but it's because he loves you.
Right.
And doesn't want you to distract everyone, including him, from the job he needs to do.
Exactly. And, you know, this is the way that Cuomo, you know, sort of eases into that CNN job. That so it will be, you know, Chris Cuomo and then Andrew Cuomo.
They'll do it together. It'll be, you know, kind of the Robert De Niro, Arnold Schwarzenegger twins reboot, CNN style.
Cuomo's? Yeah. They could call it Cuomo's.
Cuomo's with a Z on the end.
You get that Kelly
Make
Cuoco
it funky.
Too.
Yeah, or C-squared. I mean, there's a whole lot of opportunity. But Andrew Cuomo is exiting stage whichever, you know, I don't know. He'll
center.
Yeah.
I think it's probably. And he will be replaced, at least in the interim, with Kathy Hochul, who is the lieutenant governor. She is no, from a progressive perspective, she is no prize whatsoever. And however, I do not anticipate her stay in office to be terribly extended. And it will be interesting to see what we will see in terms of like the New York State Legislature, if they, you know, and what bills will or will not be signed under these circumstances. There's going to be a lot to talk about in terms of this. And remember, you know, as New York centric as this may sound for a show that is, you know, talks about national politics, we should just remind people that New York can function as a model for all sorts of types of legislation to show the rest of the country what can be done with progressive governing. And so hopefully we'll see that opportunity going forward. But it is for those of us who have had both a real problem with Andrew Cuomo's governance that goes beyond the realm of his sexual harassment over the course of really his entire tenure. This is a big opportunity for New York State because he is simply not going to be the political player that he has been, frankly, for several decades. He was a big fixer under the governorship of his father. Then spent about 10 years in at HUD, more or less, and back in New York State as AG, and then ultimately as governor. And for those of us who are always concerned that maybe this guy is going to have a national future in the Democratic Party, although I think that was concerns about that were just concerns. I don't think that they were grounded in any actual Andrew Cuomo was not going to play outside of New York State, in my estimation. But now, He is definitely not.
March 2020, Emma disagrees. Also, did I say Robert De Niro? I meant Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito? Oh, there you go. Everybody's confused about your twins reference.
I'm sorry, guys. Well, I mean, I try to keep it topical. But this is a good, you're right. This is a good day. This is a good day because, you know, I think it's apt to call him Democratic Trump, right? In terms of his politics and the way that he operates within the party and the way he bullies people and the way that he seizes control. Like, he's not a cult of personality, but there are people who still back him vociferously to this day. And if there is a vestige of that kind of politics in the Democratic Party, like, it should be cut out like a tumor. And, you know, it needed to be a sexual harassment scandal that forced him out, and it needed to be so obvious and incontrovertible that he you know, got rid of it, resigned himself. But it had to happen.
Well, I mean, I don't. You and I will have we will debate this question as to whether he was a Democratic Trump. I mean, the thing about a governor versus a president, and particularly one who had just entered into politics, is Andrew Cuomo's power was really founded in a whole network of transactional relationships in New York State. In the second half of our show, Nomi will join us, and we will have we will be digging deep into this. But this is it. Andrew Cuomo, done. I do not think that we will be hearing much about him, at least in the context of politics. And for that, that makes me happy. All right, now we're gonna take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Nick Estes. He's the host of the Red Nation podcast and the author of Red Nation Rising: From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. We'll be right back after these words. And these are the words, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, we have got a new newsletter. We had thousands of people who were enjoying the AM Quickie, but sadly, it wasn't tens of thousands of people who were enjoying the AM Quickie, which was a morning podcast we would do. You know, sometimes, you know, we had a very dedicated audience, not quite 10,000, but nearly there, who were listening to it on audio. And sometimes we get big numbers on YouTube and sometimes not, but it just wasn't sustainable, really. Since COVID, we were growing, and then COVID hit, and that's it. But we had a lot of people who really enjoyed the content, really enjoyed the context that it gave people in first thing in the morning. And so we're now delivering it to your email inboxes as an email newsletter, just one page, relatively quick, shows you what you may have missed on the show, but also gives you a heads up on stories that some of which are covered in the mainstream media and some of which are not, make fly under the radar, important things to give you a context in this day and age. And so check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. It's very easy for you to get. You just go to majority.fm, scroll all the way down to the bottom where it says newsletter. You put your email address in and you press a button, and then you're on the list. You're in the in. Send it to your friends. And read it every morning, and we never sell your email address or anything like that. Emma combs through them occasionally just to look at what the funny email addresses are, and that's it.
Right. Well, to sign up, you need to send us your password and your social security number. I hold on to those.
Don't worry about it.
You
can trust her.
On a scrap of yellow paper that I post to my refrigerator.
Don't forget, this show relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Okay. Want to welcome to the program Nick Estes. He's the host of the Red Nation podcast, author of the Red Nation Rising: From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. We should say that his contributors to that book include David Correa, Red Milicote, Brandon Benali, and Melanie Yazzie. Nick, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Hi, Thanks for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Will you just, there's a bunch of different stuff I want to talk to you about that you've also written a book in the past about water protectors and the pipelines. And we have an ongoing fight right now with Line 3, as you obviously know. But before we get there, I just want to start with Red Nation. Tell us what that is, and the activism that you've been doing.
Sure. So Red Nation was founded in the summer of 2014 after the brutal slayings of two Navajo men who were killed by vigilantes in Albuquerque. And this was part of a pattern of what they call Indian rolling in the Southwest, where predominantly non-Native or white men go around and beat up Native people, sometimes killing them. This is a historical pattern in places, you know, where I'm calling you from right now, which is a place called Rapid City, with a very high Native population, with a lot of discrimination, in places we call border towns, or the white-dominated settlements that ring Indian reservations. And in the Southwest, where the Red Nation was formed, there was also, you know, patterns of, there was the Chokecherry Massacre, as it was called in the 70s, where a group of young white high school students went and beat up Navajo men on the streets of Farmington and actually took souvenirs, cutting off fingers, cutting off pieces of skin, hanging them in their locker. So this has been an ongoing pattern of violence that is also part and parcel to police violence and surveillance of Native people off the reservation. And so the Red Nation formed kind of out of that tradition and thinking about how Native people, primarily our experiences off reservation, about 4 out of 5 Native people don't live on Federal Reserve land, but in fact live in cities. And this is part of a, you know, pattern of relocation, but also just economic opportunity off reservation. So we formed to kind of meet the needs of border town Native communities. And currently, you know, we're still based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We have an office there. We do mutual aid work. We were actively involved in the protests last summer. We've done some more community work based on like gardening, food sovereignty, and things of that nature. But we're also moving into, you know, the media realm. We have our podcast. You can all check it out. But we, you know, we are an Indigenous-led organization that centers LGBTQ leadership as well as Indigenous feminism.
Let's talk about this concept of border towns and what was it? I mean, there's obviously like a huge vacuum in just sort of I guess analyzing that concept of border. What were the origins of your deciding to write about it? But also let's talk about the concept of border towns as well.
Yeah, we, you know, academics tend to make up words, which can be helpful but also unhelpful. And so we just took the common vernacular of what Native people call these towns, which is border towns, right? Oftentimes, you know, we think of border towns as those on the U.S.-Mexico border specifically. And that kind of erases, you know, the international character of Native relationships with the United States government, because if, you know, these aren't, you know, borders, then why would the United States sign 350 treaties with Native nations if they didn't recognize their sovereignty, right? And so that's how we understand it, in just the kind of common vernacular. And there is an experience that a lot of us have, you know, in relation, like, again, going back to Rapid City, where I'm calling you from, a place called that Lakota people call Minneluzaha. There, you know, a lot of people come from the reservation to do their shopping here, right? There was recently a report that came out in CNN that described the behavior of a Rapid City police officer who was following a man who he claimed to be Native driving a Mercedes-Benz, who turned out later, according to this police officer, to be white. And so therefore he backed off and didn't pull him over. And that was just readily admitted. But this is part of a culture of police violence and surveillance of Native people off the reservation. And that's why we use that term, you know, border town, and to think of these spaces as contested spaces. Because if they weren't contested spaces, why the hyper-policing? Why the hyper-surveillance? And this might seem sort of counterintuitive to a lot of the listeners or the viewers of this show, because you may not think about Native people on a daily basis, right? And that's part of the ideological project of elimination, of eliminating Native presence from our daily lives. But that doesn't mean that Native people are somehow, you know, forgotten about by law enforcement, where there is, you know, a visible presence, especially in the U.S. West, where, you know, I've done a lot of my work, not only in community organizing, but also in journalism.
That's fascinating. So just to be clear, I mean, when you're talking about these cities or towns, the introducing essentially white people, non-Indigenous people, to the concept that this space means two different, you know, means different things depending on your perspective here, right? I mean, is that and the idea for non-Indigenous people, it's just a city that is within the United States, as opposed to the experience of Indigenous people who see this as a town that represents a multitude of different things, both positive and negative, I guess, on some level too, in terms of like perhaps some opportunities that don't exist on Native land, but also they're limited, I guess, on some level as to what the opportunities could be by the policing that takes place there.
Right. Yeah, I think y'all are calling in from New York, right? I don't know where y'all are calling in from. But, you know, New York City has the largest Native urban population. Most people don't know that because it's not readily, you know, it's not readily available. It's not like what, you know, Manhattan is a Lenape name. It's for the original people who are from there, and some of them still live there. So this idea, you know, that Native presence is always under constant erasure. And there's some studies, you know, that say, like, I think a quarter of white people in this country may have actually met a Native person in real life, you know, like that they know of, you know, that they remember. But that's part of the project, is kind of erasing these zones and boundaries and Native sovereignty in general. And, you know, if we think about like the George Floyd uprising, Minneapolis is an incredibly important city historically, you know, for one. There was an active, you know, Black freedom movement in the streets of Minneapolis in the 60s. There was something called the Soul Patrol, where Black activists would go around and surveil police violence against Black people in the streets. And they were teaming up with another organization called the American Indian Movement, who was doing the exact same thing. And so when, you know, when George Floyd was killed, it was also the Native community that was coming out at that particular time. I'm not from Minneapolis. I've only visited several times. I'm moving there next year, but, the communities, the Black and Native communities are very, you know, very much concentrated in similar areas in the city. And so there is that history. And so if we look at like an organization like the Black Panthers, for example, they formed in response to that kind of police violence. And we understand that, but we kind of don't remember that same history about the Red Power movement, that it actually formed in response to police violence off reservation. Right. And so we're really just continuing that kind of tradition. And if we look at a place like Line 3 to bring it up to the present, that is all off reservation policing and criminalization of Native people. And for what? To enforce the usurpation, not only of the land, but the rights to that water itself. And who's funding it? You know, the Public Utility Commission of Minnesota created an escrow account that Enbridge is dumping millions of dollars in to pay police overtime, right? So in many ways, we want to say that those frontiers are settled. You know, this is Northern Minnesota. It's the deep north, as they call it. And it really is. It's like, I was there. It was very, it reminded me of South Dakota, you know, and Minnesota kind of likes to pride itself as like an extension of Canada or something like that. But it really is a very, there is a very hyper visibility of being a Native person, especially in the context of the pipeline protests and especially having out of state plates. But I can talk a little bit more about that, but that is really just an intensification of what Native people experience on a daily basis living off reservation when it comes to police surveillance, harassment, and also just daily forms of discrimination.
And you mentioned the visibility of Native people in the area where Line 3, these protests are happening and the pipeline's being built. Same with the Dakota Access Pipeline. There's a reservation there. There's an understanding and a visibility. And for, I can't speak for Line 3, but when I was at the Dakota Access Pipeline, you really just get the sense that police see it as an us versus them occupying mentality. And, you know, you bring up Black Americans. That's often what we see with how police approach cities in this country. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about your perspective on that. Because when there is more visibility, as you say, a more defined Native population in an area, I'd imagine that increases this us versus them tension. And then, of course, it boils over with acts of civil disobedience when it comes to pipelines or protests.
Right. You know, the patch for the North Dakota State Patrol is actually the side profile of Red Tomahawk, who was an Indian police who assassinated Sitting Bull during an arrest in December 15th of 1890. So when, you know, water protectors were going through the court system at in North Dakota, in some of the courtrooms, they had a picture of Red Tomahawk. You know, as like, I'm not quite sure the entire, you know, the symbolism of it, but for me, it represented like an assertion of authority, of criminal jurisdiction and authority over Native people. Like, you know, one of ours killed one of yours, you know, who was also one of yours. But the way that police power was mobilized, we didn't see that kind of mobilization of police in tandem working with the National Guard, you know, since the 1890 Pine Ridge campaign, when they sent half the standing army to the reservations of the West to crush the Ghost Dance, right? And the language that they used, not just the law enforcement, but also the private security, and calling these religious, you know, inspired uprisings that were, you know, akin to jihadist terrorism, right, in the Middle East, because these contractors were veterans of those wars, either as mercenaries or as military veterans themselves. And so this was very much a militarized operation. And they now have these things called fusion centers, where they are combining military tactics and strategy to suppress pipeline or to suppress protests in rural spaces, right? And they're taking, you know, because the urban area is much different than the context, you know, of the countryside. At Standing Rock, you know, you were there. Sometimes you would march, and, you know, when you go to marches in cities, there's like cameras and there's an audience. But in the context of like these rural spaces, more isolated spaces, the camera or the audience is on the live stream, you know? And so there's a whole kind of different scenario that's at play. And in a place like South Dakota, which was expecting these massive protests akin to Standing Rock, the governor, you know, local law enforcement, the sheriff's, you know, deputies, as well as state patrol, highway patrol here, was working hand in hand with the National Guard. And the National Guard actually created, as we know now from leaked documents, created, policies and procedures that allowed them to use lethal force to protect pipeline infrastructure, right? So these are laboratories of experimentation. And this is the language that law enforcement is using. They're going around the country and teaching other law enforcement jurisdictions to do this. They're teaching the local sheriff's deputy offices that are now policing the Line 3 protest, right? So, and then to kind of bring it home into like an international context, the state of South Dakota, the state of North Dakota issued a state of emergency during the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. And that allowed them to tap into the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which had been used previously by Maryland to crush the uprisings around Freddie Gray, the killing of Freddie Gray, right? And so they solicit resources from other counties, from other municipal governments, from state governments, and they send those in. And so at Standing Rock, you had 93 or 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions, ranging from federal, border patrol down to local county sheriff's departments. And recently, the state of Arizona and the state of Texas issued declared a state of emergency concerning the influx of migrants coming from Mexico. But also, we know that they're coming from other Latin American or Central American countries. So the state of South Dakota answered the call under Christine Noem. And they're sending National Guard, right, down there. But who's footing the bill? A billionaire stepped forward and said that he would pay $1 million to deploy the National Guard in Texas, right? And so, and we know that a lot of these migrants who are coming over the border are indigenous themselves. And so this isn't just a quote unquote domestic issue, but it's completely imbricated within the war on terror kind of industrial complex, right? That has expanded not only international military operations, but domestic surveillance. And we're coming on 20 years of 9/11 and the inauguration of the U.S. war on terror. So these things continue. I think we can expect to see more of it.
We should say too, that I think that, we've seen a similar sort of transition, if you will, or mutation of the private prison industry when, investors knew 10, 15 years ago, we may see a decline in domestic prisoners and we're going to move into the immigration space type of situation. And these infrastructure are built and then they just exist and seek out sort of new products, but with that they're going to sort of run through the system on some level. But with that said, will you talk about the lineage, sort of the through time as we see the settler colonialism and what was more specifically the military that was being used to police indigenous people on some level, has just simply mutated into what you've described as a sort of a conglomeration of different police agencies that have literally fused together in these DHS fusion centers. But will you talk about that lineage and how it has been more or less unbroken, since non-indigenous people arrived here, and also how that relates to property. Mm-hmm. Because we're all funding all of this police protection for a pipe.
Right.
We're not even getting the benefits of. Like, there's just nothing, right. It's a sort of a bizarre scenario when you contemplate that.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of flies in the face of the kind of like right wing theory of like a small state, a small state government, a small government, and the proliferation of business. But in fact, we see over and over again that the massive state intervention to facilitate the accumulation of capital, the creation of private property, right, the profits over not just people, but also the land itself that nurtures and sustains us, not just native people. This isn't like some kind of esoteric argument that like somehow we're unique. Everyone drinks water, everyone breathes air. And we can see that, right, that the intervention of the state on behalf of industry is the story of this country, right? I'm going beyond the context of the book, so I apologize. The book itself is more of a primer to kind of give you the conceptual tools to understand the issue. And hopefully we'll come out with another book to kind of expand on some of these things. But the question you asked kind of goes beyond a little bit beyond the scope of the book, but it is important to talk about because the longest campaign, if you just look at the symbols of the United States, on the U.S. Army flag, there's battle streamers, right? For all the campaigns, the longest military campaign is the Indian Wars, and there are 14 battle streamers. It begins in 1790 and ends in 1891, in January of 1891, with the Pine Ridge campaign. They still consider the Wounded Knee Massacre a military engagement, a battle, so to speak. And, you know, there's 18 medals of honor that were awarded to those who killed mostly women and children that day. But the history of that kind of military intervention, you know, it is incredibly important because it's actually what created the modern military, the modern U.S. military. It was forged in the Indian Wars and also counterinsurgency. And if you're a student at West Point and you take the course on counterinsurgency, in the first chapter of the book that they assign, they talk about the Indian Wars as a model example. And they actually talk about boarding schools as a form of counterinsurgency. So there's no masking of this, of the purpose of reservations, of the purpose of the kind of military campaigns that were waged against Native people. In the military itself, it recognizes that tradition. And in many ways, you know, we say that the U.S. War on Terror is the longest war, but that's actually not true. I mean, even according to the military's own definition, if you look going back to those battle streamers, you know, there's 14 of them that lasted over a century. And so what you see with the arrival of, you know, the reservation period, especially at the end of the 19th century, is a different form of policing, right? And a different form of counterinsurgency and creating, you know, the Indian police as a kind of arm of the federal government to assert jurisdiction and, you know, control over the reservations themselves. And then you see the transition of that, right, into the 20th century, with the migration of Native people off reservation, but nonetheless still, like in places like Rapid City, still an open hostility to people living off reservation. Here in this city, for example, we talk a little bit about it in the book, but there was an urban Native population going back to the turn of the century. They moved here to this city to be closer to the children who were taken for the boarding school. And later on, when the boarding school closed down and became a tuberculosis clinic, they were pushed into a shanty town called Oshkosh Camp. Later on, that became moved north of the city, and then, you know, was turned into what we now know as Lakota Homes. But there was thousands of acres of land still in federal trust that was taken by the city itself. And so this idea that, like, you know, somehow, you know, Native people live in rural, isolated pockets of poverty, you know, somewhere else, it's somebody else's problem, kind of ignores how cities themselves, as institutions of rule, have participated in not only the policing and the surveillance of Native people, but also the taking of Native land itself. And so Rapid City is one example, right? And we can look at Albuquerque, where I currently live, and is completely surrounded by reservations to the point that it can't physically grow anymore and that it has to negotiate its water rights with the surrounding tribal nations, the Tiwa and the Tewa nations, the Pueblos that are around that particular place. And this, you know, this comes with incredible amounts of violence. Like in the reporting that I did and some of the stories that we include in the book, we talked to people on the streets. There was a Navajo woman, her name was Jolene Nez. She was actually at one of the protests that we held back in 2014 when we first formed as the Red Nation in honor of Cowboy and Rabbit, those two Navajo men who were slain by two white vigilantes, or by white vigilantes. She was there at that protest. And this last January, she was picked up on a littering charge. She was fined $150, I believe, for kicking over a cup of soup on the sidewalk in front of the place called the Indian Center, where there's a lot of services for people, the Indian community, the Native community. And she didn't show up, you know, she didn't pay her fine, and then was later picked up on a bench warrant for a $150 fine for kicking over a bowl of soup. She later died under mysterious circumstances that we don't fully understand while she was held in MDC, right? And this is during, you know, COVID-19. And this, it just shows, and this is what we talk about in the book, and this is what we talk about in terms of understanding Indigenous rights. It just shows that they're more willing to put you in jail than to offer you, you know, a home or a dignified life. And that's the premise of the book. And that's not a unique situation to just Indigenous people, but the context, the colonial context of how that policing, that surveillance, and that premature death happens.
How much, and I don't want to impose this on there, but how much of that dynamic, when we talk about colonialism and surveillance and border towns, for that matter, do you see in the context of the Palestinians and Israel occupation of Palestinian lands? And also, I'm curious as to, you know, the Palestinians speak of the Nakba, the, you know, there's a name, and it's temporally, you know, at least there's a temporal sort of flagpole for when the disaster happened, when they were physically removed from their lands in 1948. Is that type of trauma, is it harder on some level to deal with that type of trauma that exists in the context of Indigenous people in this country, when it's so temporally spread out that it's almost like you can't, it's not necessarily you can look back on it, because it's still sort of like rolling forward into time. I'm sorry, maybe those are two different questions, but they occurred to me simultaneously. I apologize.
No, it's, I had the opportunity to go to Palestine for an organization called the Palestine Literary Festival. The Palestinian literary community isn't technically really allowed to have this festival. It's been tear gassed in the past. And some people have been denied access, both Palestinian and non-Palestinian. But one thing that was, you know, I learned about the Nakba, I knew about Palestine, like theoretically, you know, about settler colonialism, but I've never seen it on the ground. And I guess the place that really kind of solidified it for me was a place called Al-Lid, which is technically within the occupied 48 territories. It's Israel claims it, right? It's sort of akin to a border town, but not really. It's that analogy doesn't really quite work and hold up. But nonetheless, the erasure of not just like Palestinian presence, but Palestinian culture, Palestinian symbols, mosques. When we actually pulled in our vehicle to go through this kind of tour of this place where there was this massacre, the man who greeted us, this Palestinian, our guide, and he was a historian, he started crying. We're like, you know, what's going on? And he said, he's like, just get off, you know, he's just get out of the car. And so we got out of the car and he walked us to a road. And he said, you know, this is a mass grave that you parked on, and they turned it into a parking lot. During the Nakba, when the IDF soldiers were coming in, this town, you know, they weren't trained, they weren't militarized, you know, they weren't like that wasn't their intention to, you know, attack Jewish settlers or anything like that. But when the IDF came through, they began to shoot people and kick them out of their homes. And so they all holed up into a mosque that was there. And the IDF soldiers, they were there for like 2 weeks, and the IDF soldiers got really upset that they were there. And so they started lobbing grenades into the mosque. And these were just mostly women and children. And they killed, they killed several hundred people and then buried them into a mass grave and then covered up the crime by putting a parking lot over it. That is what we've experienced here on multiple levels, multiple registers, as you said, both spatially and temporally, across time, across different places. Palestine is about the size of the state of New Jersey, to put that into perspective. We're talking about billions of acres of territory. We're talking about hundreds of different tribal nations with different histories, different languages. But yes, I mean, in many ways, there's an eventfulness to something like the Nakba. It happened in 1948, but it doesn't mean that it ended, so to speak, because it's an ongoing process. Much like, you know, Xelte for Navajo people, which is called the Long Walk, which would, you know, be somewhat akin to their Nakba. You know, like that is an ongoing process. They never fully recovered from that as a people, because it was meant to destroy them. It was meant to annihilate them. And genocide is something that I think people misunderstand in this country, because it's not about the utter annihilation of a people. It's about the attempted annihilation of a people. And so resistance factors into that incredibly so. And so that's what we really try to bring out in this book, something that I emphasize in this work. It's that these aren't complete processes, right? Much like decolonization, if there is a moment of that, won't be just an event, right? It'll be a process, because we're working against hundreds of years of history that we have to undo.
You write some of this in the manifesto at the end of the book, and there's also a similar manifesto that we can find on your website. But what are the key elements to that process? That of, to the extent, decolonization or that process of ending the erasure. What are things that, both from a perspective of an indigenous person and non-indigenous person, what are those things?
Land back.
Land back. Yeah. Well, yeah. I David Troyer, who had a proposal in the Atlantic, monthly, which seemed like one of the most obvious things I've ever heard, frankly, which is start with the national parks we took from indigenous people, both from like a, you know, for like just like both a justice perspective, but also from like a just purely administrative material perspective. It seems like a great way to protect these parks for people who actually care about the parks, but also, I mean, speak to that concept of land back, because I'm not quite sure that from a non-indigenous perspective, it necessarily translates. It's like, well, wait a second. We won't be, where will we go? Will you explain that concept, that it means something maybe different than we perceive of people who have like this concept of property rights that may be a little bit different from indigenous people?
Yeah. White supremacy is a fear-based ideology. So like everything that kind of challenges the status quo automatically becomes a threat. And right. And oftentimes there's a projection, right, of, oh, they're going to do to us, you know, what we did to them. And there's a cynicism attached to that. And it's completely counterproductive in understanding. I mean, this comes from both, you know, the extreme right, you know, in the state of South Dakota, they're actively removing indigenous people from the curriculum in the K-12 system and attacking the university system with this absurd threat of critical race theory. And there's even acknowledgement by these people. They're like, we don't even teach this, but we will never teach it. You know, it's like, we don't know what it is, but we don't like it. Which is just like, it's not helpful. It's not a helpful conversation. And this, you know, also comes from the left. There's always this accusation that Native people are trying to create an ethno state. It's like, bro, we live in an ethno state. Like, this is an ethno state. We're trying to be the alternative to an ethno state. But it also assumes that Native sovereignty is somehow an exclusive sovereignty. And Emily Riddle, who is a Métis theorist and scholar, you know, I had her on my show, and she made this really important, it's really beautiful comment that I still think about. She said, you know, our strength is not in our exclusivity. Our strength is in our diversity. And that's actually what our sovereignty is about, is understanding that multiple worlds can exist and overlap, and that there's not a clear like delineation between us and them, especially when we all need to live on the same land in some way. And the current mode of living on this land is one of based on, you know, private property and exclusivity. I mean, whiteness is property, and that's not a metaphor That's the reality, you know. But we also have to infuse that into a class-based politics. We can't say that the checker at Walmart has anything in common with Joe Biden, right? And that they come from, you know, various class positions, and that white supremacy has taught them that they somehow have something in common, perhaps with Joe Biden or, you know, Donald Trump, when in fact they're diametrically opposed in their outlook, but also in how they survive, you know. And so I think there's an opportunity to really infuse, this isn't just to say like, oh, this is just a race-based politics that only Native people can participate in, but it's also to fundamentally misunderstand genocide as a suppression of a certain class of people, of Native people, and to remove us, right? Whereas the poor people in Europe were removed from their land so that they had to work in factories, and then they became a surplus population to colonize this area because they were landless and, you know, looking for opportunity and new ways to make their lives. We were never seen as a viable labor pool. We were never seen as imagined in the future of this country. We were just seen as an impediment for the kind of capitalist development that we see in this country. So they annihilated a large section of us, to a part of the working class. And that's where we have to stretch our understanding of how capitalism, American capitalism develops specifically, and American imperialism develops specifically in relation to Native people. That doesn't remove us from the working class. We still, you know, and when we talk about treaty rights and we talk about clean drinking water, we talk about housing, we talk about adequate healthcare, those are things everybody needs. Like, those are universal rights, they're not particular to us. But it begins with our relationship with the land. And that's really what my understanding of land back means.
Nick Essies, host of the Red Nation podcast, author of Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. We'll put links to both those at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, quick break. Then we'll be back to say goodbye. That's it for Emma and I today. If you're watching on Peacock, and if you are, we will see you tomorrow. If you're not, stick around, because we're going to spend some time on Andrew Cuomo, I think, today. We should also say that Senate has not only passed the $1 trillion infrastructure bill, the Sinema Portman bill, but the Senate just now voted 50-49 to advance the $3.5 trillion budget resolution, which is essentially the blueprint for the reconciliation package. Mm-hmm. And now we start the Voterama, which could theoretically last until, you know, everybody poops out, right, in the Senate. But so this is going to be, and you're going to see like a wide array of amendments. Josh Hawley, I guess, already like leaked a couple of the ones that he's going to do, which is basically
spoiler alert,
no critical race theory. That's going to be a biggie.
Writers got creative with that one.
And then there's also going to be things like we're not allowed to legislate universal pre-K. You know, Josh Hawley cares about the people.
Yeah, exactly. This guy who's we can partner with to take on the corporate state and the corporate libs is calling the infrastructure bill woke.
Here we go. Okay. Allow for the hiring of 100,000 new police officers to combat the growing violent crime wave in the United States. Incidentally, New York City, our violent crime is down dramatically. Bill de Blasio is having a good week.
Oh my god, he is probably
ban critical race theory. Josh Hawley is going to do in the federal workplace diversity training because he's of the people. prohibit legislation that establishes government-run universal pre-kindergarten and childcare. Now, that sounds like really scary, but in other words, you can only have private preschool, not you cannot take the public school, elementary school down the block that has kindergarten, and you can't have those government-run bureaucrats extend it to pre-K. Because, of course, you know what happens. They make them all wear, like, Chairman Mao shirts at pre-K. Restrict federal funding for K through 12 schools because he is of the people that mandate COVID-19 vaccines for students or mandate students wear masks or do not resume in-person instruction because these people are so much about local control. But we will cover all of that later. All right. Just a reminder, your support makes this show possible. Joining us for the fun has Nomi Const joining us right now, who is going to tell you who's going to be on her show tomorrow night, if she knows.
I can preempt her while she's joining.
Please do. I am sorry. You know, you should have jumped in. I knew you were itching to let your North Dakota freak flag fly during that.
Well, no, I mean, Nick's work, I'm excited to read this one, but also the Code Access Pipeline book. I mean, it really informed the way I look at my hometown, and Bismarck Mandan is definitely one of those hometowns. He mentioned Sitting Bull. One of the first corporations that I know from my hometown, Mandan, North Dakota, is the Sitting Bull Log Cabin Company.
Oh, nice!
Which took Sitting Bull, after he was assassinated, took his cabin around the upper Midwest, like Chicago and stuff, to just show it off. Say, so here's where this guy lived. So,
literally took it? Literally like took on his tour? Cabin
and like, yeah, like took it on tour. So that was one of the first companies, businesses in my hometown.
And then what's their second bit? What do they do after that?
I don't know. I've actually been looking up sources. All I have is this old photograph. If you search Sitting Bull Log Cabin Company, you can see the guys in front of it.
Oh, that's nuts. And then what do they do? Build their own log cabins or like based upon this guy
it was just like if you go to like the World's Fair or whatever, you can go walk in Sitting Bull's cabin and see what, you know, it was like to be in there. Just really grotesque.
Really nuts.
You're from Mandan, like where the Dakota Access Pipeline was, where all the protests were? Right. I've been there. Wow. I didn't know that. Damn.
Wow.
So, yeah, but I'll just plug Left Reckoning real quick, not Literary Hangover. There's nothing new there. But Left Reckoning, Corey Pine and David Griscom and I had a really good conversation about UFOs and what's going on there, where I tell why I left the skeptic community for the leftist community, sort of online the last 10 years. Also, we talk about the far right and how we should probably still be worrying about them coordinating with the police more than them getting entrapped by the police. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that conversation.
Wait, I have a question. You left the skeptic community about UFOs?
No, it was mainly over there in curiousness about, like, so the JFK assassination, right?
Okay.
That was it, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought there was a skeptic UFO community and a leftist UFO community.
There's not, well, I guess the Posadists are sort of the leftist UFO community, but I'm not really.
But that's
a part
not
of
what
that.
You were talking no. about. That conversation that was not necessarily associated with UFO.
Well, you were saying that it was because their like concerns had no curiousness about earthly or like monetary.
Skeptics like to do technical debunking. So, for instance, it puts them in a bad situation. Say, for instance, with climate change, like because that's not about the technical facts of the matter. That's about politics and everything surrounding that. And skeptics have a blind spot when it comes to that. I think it's also evident in the JFK assassination. And probably in UFOs, even though I don't really believe that aliens are visiting us.
Where is it evident in the JFK assassination? I feel like
JFK is all focused on Dealey Plaza and trajectories and bullets and this. If
shooter,
and absolutely zero curiosity about like
the forces that might be interested in what he was doing.
Lee Harvey Oswald's all his like military and like sort of connections that make him obviously look like a spy or some kind of asset for somebody. Like just no, the skeptics don't even address that. It's just like it doesn't exist.
Right. Nomi.
What's up?
Every time we see you, your background has changed in some way.
You know, I'm just a traveling TV host. I don't know what I am.
Travel with that big light behind
you. You know what? It has to do with the sunlight. That's what it has to do with. Most you know, it's like 8 o'clock here at night. And so the sun is starting to set like a little bit earlier. And normally I have a lot more daylight. That's the jam.
Well,
and the light that I brought all the way across the globe burned out because of one of those little cables, you know, the things that you have to connect it to. It totally blasted out. And so my lighting's not the best, I'm not going to lie.
Converter.
Yeah, converters have killed me. It also like killed my phone.
What? So. Who's going to be on your show to tomorrow night?
Well, we're going to have to change some things probably rapidly, but we're going to keep these guests. We're not leaving them out. We have Shahid Buttar on, and we also have Harvey Kay who comes on every month. But given the Cuomo news, I'm probably going to shift some things very quickly. We were already going to do it, but my bet was always he was always going to step down by Wednesday morning. So I got close, got very close. Yeah, that was my bet. I had a bet going with some people. I won the bet, by the way. I made some money. There so listen, Cuomo may have come after me and threatened my life, all sorts of horrible things in my life. So many others have gone through it, but at least I've made a little bit of money in the last couple of days off of his demise. You know, I don't wish for many people, but for Cuomo, I feel like,
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's take a quick break. And when you come back, we will talk more about Andrew Cuomo.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.